Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts, free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate, Sutton Properties, our new company name, along with my co-host, Teresa Martin, who's one of our agents. Hi, Teresa.
Hello, Lou.
How was your lunch?
It was slow, but I finally got it, and I made it.
All right. Buying and selling homes, land or farms, or want to auction your property in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia, just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street next to BB&T Bank in downtown Violet Mountain, North Carolina. Please make a note of our changes. Our new company website is www.allsuttonproperties.com. That's A-L-L-S-U-T-T-O-N properties.com. Just a program note, Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at 10 a.m., so stay tuned. And Dr. Barbie always has something of interest to talk about. Our guest today is my best friend, Christina Asbury. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me, Lou.
You're very welcome. I've been wanting to have you for a long time, so you made the schedule this time. Just a little bit. You're an accredited land consultant like myself, a member of the Realtors Land Institute, and that's how we met, probably around 2006, something like that, at one of our land classes or conferences. But you also carry a couple of other acronyms, and people don't realize this. You know, you get your real estate license, and you go out and you sell real estate, but, you know, there's advanced education that's provided by the National Association of Realtors, and these are specialties like selling land or commercial or property management or international. But you have the ABR, accredited buyer's recognition.
Representative. Mm-hmm.
And then you got the CRS, that's Certified Residential Specialist.
Yes, sir.
And then you got the MRP, that's Military
Relocation Professional, yes.
Here
at Camp Lejeune, Marine Corps base, we have quite a bit of military personnel that come in and out.
I bet you do. It's one of the largest bases in the country, isn't it?
Yes, sir. The largest installation on the East Coast.
Yeah. And then you've got the SFR designation. What's that?
Short Sale and Foreclosure Resource.
Okay.
We all had to get schooled on that through the recession.
Gotcha. Are you seeing much of that right now? Is that kind of slowed down?
No, not really.
Kind of slowed down.
There's a few short sales and foreclosures, but they're mostly related to Hurricane Florence-related damage.
Right. You're with Caldwell Banker, Seacoast Advantage, and your office is in Sneed's Ferry, North Carolina. That's just west of Topsail Island, right?
I am sitting about 1 mile from the beautiful beaches of Topsail Island. Yes, sir.
I've been to your offices. They're fantastic. You got some incredible agents down there. I think you were involved in having me come down and I believe it was my four-hour class, Introduction to Land Brokerage, and we did it at your office, and it's really nice. I love your broker in charge. He's super.
Yes, sir.
And today, after you finish teaching me all about selling land at the coast, I'm going to move down there and come to work with you.
No, you're not.
I want to go to the beach.
Well, we're going to go over all the things you need to know before you buy something here today.
One of the things we want to talk about, and we really haven't, and this is applicable anywhere in the United States, is the difference in buying ocean property land versus like what Teresa and I sell, rural land, mountain land. You know, what people come to our office, they want views. And what they do when they come to your office, they want ocean. So there's a lot more involved that we're not familiar with, and we want you to help mentor us today, if you would, Christina, in our listening audience. Just a little bit on your background, too. I want to toot your horn. You're on the Oslo County Planning Board of Adjustments. You've been an ALC since 2008, accredited land consultant, and there's roughly 500 of us in the United States. And our website's www.rliland.com, and you can go there and find a member. There's 1,300 of us roughly around the United States, and definitely can identify the accredited land consultant. You want to use the best person with the most knowledge when you're involved in real estate. You're also, RLI was appointed you on the Professional Standards Committee. I was on that many years ago. The North Carolina Realtors Past Chair for Pro Standards, SPC for the North Carolina House Representative Philip Shepard. You were North Carolina Realtor Legislative Committee. North Carolina William C. Bass Leadership Academy Graduate School, where you were the Yeller Realtor of the Year, both for Topsail Island and Jacksonville Board of Realtors. Those are two wonderful honors. Exceptional Service Award for the Jacksonville Board of Realtors, and I'm sure you are exceptional and well-deserved. And you were elected the president for JBOR. What's JBOR?
Jacksonville Board of Realtors.
Okay, sorry. And then 2011, you were awarded the Realtors Land Year of the Year, and I was there and watched that presentation. I've actually received it twice since 1998, since I've been a member. And you've also been the past president of our chapter, the Carolinas Chapter of Realtors Land Institute. So,
yes, sir.
Busy lady.
I get around.
Yeah.
You must have been doing this a while.
Yeah, I've been in the business for about 16 years now.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty here. What are some of the issues that we deal with at the coast, like waterfront properties and special considerations that we run into?
Well, there's a lot of land in the United States, but 40% of our total population lives near the coast. But the coastal areas account for less than 10% of all the land, not counting Alaska. So whether you're talking about oceanfront properties, soundside, mainland waterfront, or even riverfront, you've got to know things about the riparian and littoral rights as far as the ability to use certain portions of that and what belongs to the state or the federal government.
Does that also involve decking and, you know, protrusion into the water?
Absolutely, yes. And each state has their own regulatory agency for those. Here in North Carolina, it's the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources. You have to get what's called a CAMA permit, which would be a permit that is reflective of the Coastal Area Management Act. So there are certain limitations and things that you can and can't do and regulations within those areas.
Now, riparian property rights deal with owners of land adjoining streams, rivers, lakes, relating to water and its usage, and then riparian rights allows a property owner to use water from a water course such as a river, stream, or creek. And then you got littoral rights, which concern properties abutting an ocean, a sea, or lake rather than a river or a stream. Littoral rights are usually concerned with the use of the enjoyment of the shore. So there's, again, even down to the cities and the counties, they have regulations along with the state and then with the federal government. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you may see different.
You're correct. And the thing is generally you're going to own to the high water mark, you know, the mean high water, the average high water mark, if you border a water body, per se. So you have the right to do certain things all the way to that high water mark if it's a title property. But there are some other considerations, too, especially with the oceanfront that we'll get into later in our discussion.
And then you got navigable and non-navigable bodies of water, such as a river or canal or lake. Navigable is usually a deep, wide, or slow enough for a vessel to pass or walk. Preferably, there are few obstructions, such as rocks and trees, to avoid. Bridges must be sufficiently clearance, and in high water speed, make a channel unnavigable sometimes. Water may be unnavigable because of ice, particularly in the winter. Navigable depends on context. A small river may be navigable by a small craft, such as a motorboat or a kayak, but unnavigable by a cruise ship. Shallow rivers may be navigable for installation of locks and increase the regular water depth by dredging. So defined by the U.S. Corps of Engineers, which were established.
And, you know, one of the things to keep in mind there is a lot of realtors who aren't familiar with land or coastal water area properties may advertise a property as having deep water.
Uh-huh.
But deep is a relative term. There's no such thing as deep water. What's deep to me may not be deep to you. What my John boat will fit in might not be the draft or the amount of water needed for your Bayliner or your Grady White. So it's very important if you are purchasing a property and you have a boat and that's important to you and one of your decision-making factors to investigate that during your due diligence period and make sure that there's enough water in there, even at low tide, to get your vessel, whether it's a canoe, kayak, or a great big yacht, in and out of that property.
So caution to buyers and sellers and cautions to agents about using the word deep water. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because deep is relative, just like quiet neighborhood.
Okay.
So, you know, we mentioned earlier as far as ocean properties, sometimes you'll have easements recorded for public use or public enjoyment or for local governmental authorities to be able to do activities like beach renourishment or sand pushing. So if you own an oceanfront property here at Topsail Island, for example, all of those oceanfront properties have got that easement for public enjoyment across the front. So basically that means you can't go up on both of your side property lines and put up a fence and prevent people from using that beach and walking up and down and putting their beach chair out there or picking up seashells. You can't close it because it's there for everyone to use and enjoy.
So is that for all beachfront property, or is there some private, or is it all?
I would imagine that there would be some private.
Safe.
That's something that would need to be looked into. You've got some islands like Figure Eight Island, Hilton Head, some of the other ones that may have some different regulations on that or may not need those easements. But for the properties I deal with here, it's very common to see those.
Okay.
And then again, like the Outer Banks, for example, in North Carolina, you know, they may not be restricted either. They may be restricted where you can't block is my point. Where, say, for Figure Eight Island, which is more of a private development, you know, that's gated and it's not really open to the public, they have their own private beaches. And they pay for it, too. Very expensive down there.
Yeah, they do. Right now, we've got a $22 million beach renourishment project underway. So sand is definitely not a cheap thing to put on the beach when it's needed.
I was lying on the beach last year watching them dredging the sand. Who pays for that? Is that tax money or...
Well, it's all tax money. It all comes from taxes.
Well, I was just wondering, like, is it state or is it a local thing? I mean, I was just wondering. We were discussing it last year as we were lying on the beach because, you know, every time a storm comes, the sand goes away.
Yeah, it depends. Generally, I would say generally the money for beach renourishment comes from federal taxpayer dollars.
Federal tax, okay.
Usually you're going to be part of a federal program that will honor your long-term plans to lay out what years you're going to do beach renourishment. It's not a knee-jerk reaction. You can't apply this year for next year necessarily. You actually have to have a renourishment plan over a period of several years and then get that approved by the federal government. Now, with certain situations, like we have New River Inlet here near Sneed's Ferry. It's the inlet that borders between Topsail Island and Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune. That inlet has a bunch of sand that is washed into it, and you can literally walk across it at low tide. It's only 3 or 4 feet deep. That particular situation, because it's part of the intracoastal waterway, it can be classified under a transportation budget. So sometimes whenever you have water, like rivers or inlets or things like that may be used for commercial fishermen or things like that, it can be, like say, classified under transportation and get money from a state transportation fund for dredging activities in areas like that.
Okay.
All right. So have we covered that pretty good? Is there anything else we need to go on the riparian?
I think the only other thing with the waterfront property considerations is that homes and buildings that are waterfront may actually not be rebuildable if they are damaged to a certain extent, whether that's through a hurricane or whatever. Older properties may not be on conforming lots, which means the structure or the home does not meet the setback requirements that are outlined by building code or the Coastal Area Management Act or whatever, what have you. In those situations, if your home is damaged more than 51%, they can require you to relocate your home and meet the new setbacks. So, for example, on the ocean down here, the thing that they go off of for DENR and DWQ for CAMA purposes is you're supposed to be 60 feet back from the first line of established natural vegetation. So what they do is they send a representative from the state agency out to find where that first line of vegetation actually is and determine where that root system starts. Then they will stake that point, and you have to go back 60 feet before your home or your structure can be built. That's the minimum setback.
Christina, we're going
to... If you're looking at oceanfront properties, you may have homes that are located right on top of the dunes or right in front. You want to make sure there's enough room on that lot to move that home back in the event that it's damaged and be able to rebuild it kind of on the same lot, but meeting that setback requirement.
Okay, our guest today is Christina Asbury. Let's talk land. So we talked about setbacks. Now, why would I want to come down there, Teresa, come down there and buy a home that in the future, because of a storm, may be demolished, and I won't be able to build another home back on the lot? I mean, does that happen down there?
Oh, yes, it happens quite a bit. You know, Mother Earth and nature give us, or as they say, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Sand is always coming and going, especially depending on the geographical situation of the property and how the currents flow and things like that. So a lot of times, I even listed a property this week that's on a non-conforming lot. So that means that the house does not meet the setback requirement. And then on the back side of the home, it's road front. So not only can we not meet the 60-foot setback, we also would have a utility and road easement setback from the roadside. There's just not enough room on this lot for that to be rebuilt. So we've had a lot, as you can imagine, I've had a lot of interest on this home because it's priced very competitively. I'll say the most affordable oceanfront in North Carolina. There's an investment strategy that you can use when looking at properties that may be on non-conforming or non-rebuildable lots. And the way that you have to look at it is from a numbers perspective or an investment perspective. The most that a federal flood policy is going to pay out in the event of a total loss is a $250,000 cap on a payout. Whether you've got a $400,000 home or a $2 million home, the most you're going to get out of FEMA is $250,000. So if I've got this oceanfront that I put on the market 2 days ago at $400,000, if it brings in $50,000 a year in rental income, and then you can get $250,000 in the event of a total loss, it's a numbers game. How many years can I carry that property as a vacation rental, making money, turning a profit, before, if I lose the house, it's not going to make me cry and go into a spiral depression? At that point,
exactly,
you would still end up with your $250,000. You can go and put that down and buy another beach property a little further back if you want. So, for example, my sellers bought this property years ago, understood those numbers, and they've had it for 6 years, bringing in $40,000 to $50,000 worth of rental income. Those numbers made sense for the investment strategy of my client. It's not going to work for everybody, but for somebody who can afford to do it and understand the taxes on it and the money flow, it can be a really good investment for the right person.
Christina, as realtors, how do you guys market that? How would we know as a buyer looking for that type of property that an MLS or the websites that meets those criteria? Is that something that you advertise, or a lot of realtors don't know that?
Our local MLS does not have the criteria for non-conforming lots. So it really comes down to hire an agent who understands that local market, because as we know, real estate is hyper-local. You cannot hire somebody to represent your interest as a buyer that is 100 miles inland that only vacations here at the beach.
So Teresa,
they don't understand what's going on.
So Teresa, you cannot go to the beach and sell beach property.
Yes, I can. I just got to understand it. Okay. Let me see. I had a question.
You have to understand it. Exactly.
Lou just knocked it out of my head.
Oh.
Okay, I know what it was. So if it's non-conforming, the way that I understand, and I guess it's from area to area, if it's non-conforming, then the person that's using it can use it, but then the new person that buys it cannot use it in the same manner.
No, they could use
that,
it.
They could?
They could use it. So you got to start the clock again with those rentals, anticipating that it may be another 4 or 5 years before there's a disaster.
Okay. Well,
and the other thing is if you want to make changes to the property, you may be asked to bring it into compliance. So there may be limitations if you wanted to do a complete remodel or add on, add square footage to one.
That's where I was going, right there.
There may be limitations because it's a non-conforming
if it,
lot.
That's where I was going. If it's non-conforming, do you have to bring it up to some sort of code?
I know my friend up in Bath, New Jersey, they had a beach home that they invested in, and they decided that they wanted to increase the size of it, but because of the lot setback limitations, they couldn't get a permit to do it. So what he did was he jacked the house up a full story and put another story underneath it to go around the ordinance. But, you know, that they couldn't object to it. He wasn't changing the lot lines. And so that was a workaround in that situation, which I thought was kind of interesting. Do you see that in North Carolina at all, Christina?
Not necessarily. I think that, I mean, all of that is going to be determined by your local building inspector, right, your local building codes, in conjunction with state representatives for those areas. You know, ultimately, the thing to remember is if the cost of repair and the damage to the house is more than half of the value of the house itself, then you could be considered having to rebuild. Your local building inspectors are going to make those decisions. It just kind of depends. It's up to them and up to their judgment.
In your market area, how many non-conforming opportunities are there, percentage-wise?
There's a lot of them.
Really?
You know, going back to how can you identify them, it's right, usually the more affordable beachfront properties. And typically, I can have a client or a prospective consumer buyer call me and say, hey, 123 Ocean Boulevard, what's the deal with this house? Why is it so cheap? This doesn't make sense. And I can pull that up in less than 5 minutes from aerials and make an educated guess and take a position on, well, that lot may not be rebuildable. That's probably why it's priced accordingly.
So that doesn't show up on the tax card, for example, as an entry?
No, because the thing is you may have a lot that's not conforming right now, but maybe over the next 2 years, a bunch of sand floats right down the beach and gets deposited onto your section of beach and extends that line of natural vegetation out further.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe the vegetation on the dunes grows down the front of the dunes. It adds 5 feet to it. So, you know, you really can't say that just because it's non-conforming now, it won't be in the near future.
So you're not buying a lot that's 100 by 100 by 100. You're buying a lot that may be 100 by 100 by 90 or 100 by 100 by 110, right? I mean, is that right?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, that one property that I put on the market this week, it's 60 foot. 60 foot by, I think, 110.
Right.
But you have to remember on the oceanfront properties, like we've discussed, the property line goes all the way to the mean high water line.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's the variable.
A good portion of that lot is the beach in front of it.
So that's the variable. I got you. Okay.
So if it's not rebuildable, and your house gets demolished by a storm, and the lot is still there, it's just nothing on it from here on?
No. See, that's a great question. I love that. What you have at that point is a private deeded beach access to sell to the people on the second or third row behind it.
Oh, cool. Good job.
So how does that affect the value of that lot? You know, because in taxing, the land has a value and then the structure has a value. Now the structure's been removed and can't be rebuilt, but you still have the land value, right? How does that...
Mm-hmm.
What is that marketable? Is that, I mean, just like a regular retail lot that you could build on, or is it discounted because you can't build on it?
No, it's going to be discounted. Most of the most of the beach access lots like that are being sold in my area are going for between $15,000 and $40,000, just depending on where it's located and what it's near.
Okay, 15 to 40.
The properties behind it who may purchase that, like say I've got a second or third row home, and let's say it's a quarter of a mile to the nearest public beach access. If I can pick up that lot and give my house deeded beach access, I've now increased the value of my home that's not oceanfront.
Yeah.
See what you're learning today,
that's
Teresa?
That's cool. Yeah, that's creative.
Now, don't teach Teresa too much. She'll leave us and come down there and work with you.
Oh, that's my dream.
You come on down, girl.
It is my dream to move to the beach.
All right, watch out. She's packing her bags. Anything else on that subject?
No, not necessarily. I think that it all just depends on what your goals are for the property that you're buying.
But a
primary residence buyer is going to have completely different considerations than someone who just wants something that's going to be a rental machine and make them money.
Okay, let's move to wetlands. You got quite a bit of that down there. Adaptable ecological climatology.
Well, areas of environmental concern is kind of what that goes into. And, you know, those are identified because they're important to the ecosystem. You know, wetlands are generally your swamps, your marshes, your bottomlands. And they're a predominant coastal habitat type in North Carolina. I think I heard a statistic one time, 80 to 90% of the world's endangered species live only in wetlands, and that is their habitat. So it's important to protect those.
Yeah, I want to give a plug out to one of our buddies, Mark Seelinger, the Swamp School in Raleigh, North Carolina. I know you've had some classes, had him down to your associations over the years, and I've taken a class with him many years ago. And he's one of the foremost experts, at least on the East Coast, of the wetlands and all the things to go. And we actually did a show. I can't remember what show it was, but if you'll go to our website, www.letstalklanding, want to learn about wetlands and mitigation, Mark is highly recommended. So you've got tidal freshwater marsh. What's that?
Well, tidal freshwater marsh is going to be the areas where, where in the coastal plains where they have flooding by lunar or wind tides, you'll hear things about the king tide. About once or twice a year, we'll have a king high tide. That means it crests really high, and it's due to the lunar position and the lunar cycle. Also, you can get tidal freshwater marshes where the wind blows the water into certain areas or out of. Those marshes are usually going to be freshwater and the salinity is low. That's going to be, I would say, more the swamps up around the river before it gets down to the salt water.
Is most of that in conservation easements, privately owned, governmentally owned?
Oh, absolutely. There's conservation easements in the freshwater marshes or the saltwater marshes.
Okay, but I mean,
we've got a lot of conservation area in our part of the country.
Yeah, but I'm saying the majority of it is not privately owned?
I would say it depends. We have a lot of state game land systems down here. The Audubon Society actually owns quite a bit of those types of areas for the birds.
Birds got to have some place to go, Teresa.
Yep.
They got to have somewhere to lay their eggs, that's for sure.
So what's the difference in that we're talking about in this salt brackish marsh? You have to have a whole new language if you go to the beach.
I'm telling you, I have already decided that.
So salty ocean tides provide flooding of salt marshes and brackish marshes. So, for example, here again at Topsail Island, the intercoastal waterway runs along the backside. We have, you know, marshes and soundside on both sides, mainland waterfront areas and things. You know, you may be able to walk out on the grass flats at low tide, but when it's high tide, you may have a foot to two of water. It just depends on how close you are to the inlet and, again, what the lunar cycle is for the tides. Usually that's going to be a mixture of fresh and salt water, oyster grass, cord grass. There's certain types of grasses that you can identify those in. The big thing about those marsh areas is they're important nursery grounds for commercial fishing industries and recreational fishing industries. And shellfish is a big deal. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of trying a stump-found oyster, but we have some of the best oysters in the United States right here in North Carolina.
I haven't, and next time I come down, we're going to make sure I get some. It sounds delicious. So, again, is that Is that privately owned, or is that owned by conservation easements or government organizations?
I would say that those marsh areas are not really going to be privately owned, because if you go back to the littoral rights and the riparian rights, you own to the high water line. Everything under that high water line, all the land underneath it, is going to be owned by the federal government or the state or whatever, depending on what it is. So I would say no, those marshes are not generally owned. But if you go on the mainland side and even on the sound side, sometimes the property boundary lines on the surveys and the plats will extend out into the marsh. There are some small pieces that have little islands and things back in the sound that are privately owned. And, you know, those people own them for a number of reasons. There's one guy that has one little island, and he literally has a duck blind built on it.
Our guest today is Christina Asbury.
For every property.
Sorry. Our guest today is Christina. I didn't mean to step on you. Our guest today is Christina Asbury. Let's Talk Land. So part of all this buying property at the ocean deals with the Army Corps of Engineers. Now, the Wilmington District, I think, is in your area, right? They're out of Fort Chiswell, or Caswell, and they employ over 400 employees in North Carolina, Virginia. And, of course, the Wilmington District team provides expertise across a wide range of disciplines, from engineering, architecture, design, construction, hydropower, recreational management, hydrology, and environmental stewardship. So, in your part of the world, I mean, up here we deal with the Corps of Engineers if someone wants to build a pond, you know, if, as long as you don't go 15 feet over the inside dam height, you don't have to get a permit. But if you exceed that, you're going to have the Corps of Engineers involved. I would say in your area, they do a whole lot more than monitor ponds.
Absolutely, Lou. Due to the sensitivity of the coastal watershed areas and the wetlands, any proposed development really should give consideration to the wetlands and how the stormwater flow and erosion may impact them. There's a lot of flora and fauna that only really thrive in wetlands. Therefore, the regulations exist to protect them. If there are wetlands on a survey or your development plans, you're probably going to have to get the Army Corps of Engineers to come on site for an evaluation at some point to determine exactly where and what kind of wetlands you can you actually have. This can take some time, so you really need to give yourself time during your contract and your due diligence period to have them come out. There are usually going to be restrictions on development near wetlands, like additional setback requirements, erosion control measures, stormwater runoff plans. But ultimately, knowing a good coastal engineer and a good coastal surveyor will greatly help you get a plan together that can be approved easier by all the powers that be.
Now, those are private, those are private individuals. Yes? You're not talking about Corps of Engineer staff. You're talking about private engineers and surveyors, right?
It's just like, you know, it's not always the best option to go to the county for a septic evaluation. In our area, it's better to hire a soil engineer and pay the extra money so that you know that you can get what needs to be done. Same thing with a good coastal engineer. If you're doing a development or building within those areas that may have wetlands, the engineer and the surveyor is going to know what the Corps of Engineers is going to want. And I've actually seen some of our local engineers go to bat and go toe-to-toe with the Corps of Engineers and say, look, in my professional opinion, this is not where the line should be. It should be over here. Now you tell me why. And our coastal, our private engineers that you hire, they win quite a few of those arguments, actually.
Right. And I'm sure you have a list of those names available if someone's interested and needs some help.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, your engineer is going to have contacts at local mitigation banks. So if you have to disturb some wetlands, you can rely on those mitigation banks or conservation easements as alternatives to be able to achieve the goals that you have for the parcel.
Right. And I'll refer you to Mark Selinger's show on what you just talked about. So mitigation, that's a whole subject.
Highly recommend Swamp School. Mark Selinger does a great job with that course and the information that they put out.
Absolutely. And he's multi-state. I think he's in 8 or 10 or 12 states, so it's not just here in North Carolina. What about stormwater regulations? That's a very important part, I guess, especially if you're doing like a commercial development or doing a multi-complex residential apartments, condos, townhomes like that.
Stormwater flow is always something important, especially since Hurricane Florence. We have realized that there has been a great disservice done in coastal North Carolina with regards to keeping in mind how much rainwater moves and how quickly it can accumulate. The other thing that was interesting, I just heard that they found some 2,200 beaver dams in our coastal area that were impeding the flow of water that contributed to the flooding that we had following Hurricane Florence. So, different topic there, but the Wildlife Resources Commission has been working on breaking up beaver dams, and actually the explosives unit from the Marine Corps base has been blowing up beaver dams on base property lately, so wow. We've had some houses shaken.
Leave it to beaver.
But ultimately, stormwater flow is really important to take into consideration. In our area, you may be required to do a stormwater pond. You may just have to do some ditching. It just kind of depends. That's a case-by-case basis, and you got to have a state permit for any kind of, major development in these areas.
I'm going to go to the beach with a whole different perspective this year.
We're going to look for beaver dams?
I'm going to look for ditches and ponds and weird stuff now.
You don't want her down there working.
I know, but stuff like that is just interesting to me, and it's just something different.
She likes different.
I like different.
So there's a lot
And when I'm looking at properties, one of the things I'll do when I do site visits is because we're in the flatland, I'll look for the ditches, and I'll follow that ditch bank and see where it goes and try to determine where the water off of this parcel is going to run if it rains for 3 days straight.
Yeah, that's important.
And those are considerations that you need to keep in mind regardless of what improvements you want to make on the property.
See, I never even considered that.
Well, we don't have it here.
I know.
Or if we do, I don't know.
It just runs off the side of the hill.
That's right.
Because we got a lot of hills.
So there's a lot of mitigations. We were referring to wetland mitigations, but there's a lot of other type of mitigations that investing in land may involve. Some of them are, and this is through FEMA, hazard mitigation grant program. They've got a pre-disaster mitigation. I assume that's if you know that a storm or hurricane's coming, they may be do some preliminary evaluations to predetermine areas that might be affected. Flood mitigation assistance through FEMA, and of course, National Flood Insurance Program, NFIP, they participate in some of these mitigation options. So is flood insurance, let's talk about flood insurance, because I know that's a costly topic, or can be, if you're investing in land at the ocean.
Yeah, the number one thing, if you're looking at any properties anywhere near water, the first thing you should do is check to see if the county, the city, the municipality, the town, wherever that parcel lies, make sure that the area is part of the National Flood Insurance Program. Not all towns, cities, municipalities, and counties participate in that. But in order to get federally backed flood insurance, they need to be part of the NFIP. They have a community rating system that's a voluntary program for community floodplain management activities. It'll actually give some credit to the homeowners, kind of like when you have a really good fire department program, everybody benefits by a reduction in the expense. Same thing with the insurance program. If you can get part of that, get a part of that community rating system and take on some of those floodplain management activities that'll exceed the minimum requirements, everybody can benefit. Participation in that program through the National Flood Insurance Program, it provides discounts to the flood insurance policyholders, because the community's working together to reduce flood damage to the properties, which strengthen and support the insurance aspects of the program, and it makes everybody have a more comprehensive approach to floodplain management.
This doesn't have anything to do with floodplain maps, right? I mean, that's in our area, that's what we deal with. I mean, it does have something to do with it, but it's more than that, right?
Mm-hmm. It is more than that. And, you know, not all communities are part of the NFIP, so therefore not all property owners can purchase FEMA-backed flood insurance. The other option is a private flood policy.
Right.
Just like you can go through, you know, healthcare.gov for insurance, or you can get a hold of Blue Cross Blue Shield and get your own private policy. Sometimes private flood insurance policies have more coverage or better coverage, especially for investors, we've learned since Florence again. Florence taught us a lot of lessons.
Yeah, I did.
But private flood policies can be more affordable in some cases and sometimes will provide better coverage. You should always compare both types of policies during your due diligence just to see what those are and to pick the one that's best for your intended use. For example, we figured out that the FEMA-backed flood insurance didn't always have a coverage for loss of use for people who owned homes that were vacation rentals. So, for example, if they're losing out on their $50,000 in rental income because their home was damaged and is under repair, the FEMA flood insurance, that federal flood insurance, didn't cover them for the loss of use for all those weeks they could have rented their home. However, some of the private flood insurance companies did provide that type of coverage. And you're talking tens of thousands of dollars.
So is that the COBRA zones they're talking about in private flood insurance, the Coastal Barrier Resource Act that was passed in 1982? Well, is that what you're referring to?
I'm glad that you bring that up, yes. The Coastal Barrier Resources Act was passed by Congress back in 82, and it was made to encourage conservation of hurricane-prone, biologically-rich coastal barrier areas. In our case, the main one that we have on Topsail specifically, it was designed, well, the way it happened is a guy literally was in an airplane, literally, riding in an airplane, looking out the window, looked down, and said, oh, look, there's no development there, there's no infrastructure, this whole section of beach is just a protective barrier island for the mainland. So this should be part of the COBRA zone, and they drew a big circle around the north end of Topsail Island, with some exceptions.
Right.
What that effectively did is it makes those areas within the COBRA zones not eligible for FEMA-backed National Flood Insurance Program insurance. So your only option, if you pick a parcel or a residence in a COBRA zone, is going to be private flood insurance. That's all you can get. You will not be able to get a government loan in those areas because government loans, FEMA or FHA, VA, those types of loans are government-backed loans. So, of course, they want government-backed insurance policies to protect their assets and the structure. But when you're in a COBRA zone, you're only going to get private flood insurance.
What do you find in the difference in cost?
You know, it's just, there really isn't a difference in cost. I mean, it depends on the specific property. Just like no two vehicles are going to have the same insurance rate.
Right.
It depends on the driver. It depends on a lot of factors. If your car's red, you're going to pay more.
So I could have a
door, you're going to pay more.
So I could have
kind of the same thing with the insurance. I mean, I have seen private flood policies everywhere between $2,000 and $32,000. But I've also seen federal flood policies that can range in such a huge area that it makes no sense either. It really comes down to the individual property.
So I can have a piece of property and be under one insurance type, and Therese can be my next-door neighbor and be in a different because of the line that was drawn, right?
Absolutely, yes, sir. And you may have different coverages, different deductibles, and everything could be different about those policies.
When you're doing a site preview, Christina, is that something that you have a map that you can refer to know exactly where those delineations are?
Absolutely. You know, interestingly enough, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is who is in control of the COBRA zones. So you can go on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife website and you can pull up those maps for the entire United States. This is not just a North Topsail Beach, North Carolina situation. There are COBRA zones in every single state, I would say, in every waterfront coastal area.
Well, in my notes here,
really want to be careful.
In my notes here, it says the Atlantic, the Gulf of Mexico, the Great Lakes, U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico coast. Over 1.4 yes. million acres of land is associated with aquatic habitat that they monitor.
And you know what's interesting about our little section of the beach is the guy in the airplane that flew over couldn't see all the building permits that had been issued. He couldn't see the sewer and water lines and the infrastructure that was already in place.
Yeah.
In our situation, that was literally an error on behalf of Congress. And unfortunately, it's going to take an act of Congress to undo it,
yeah.
which our legislators have been working on forever. It's really hard. But if you have coastal barrier resources areas on your property and you want to get them removed, the buck stops with U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Interesting. Well, what about wind and hail insurance?
Wind and hail. That's the number one type of insurance people forget they need when you live near the coast. Most of the damage that I saw for the property owners I'm representing currently with beach properties or waterfront properties wasn't necessarily damage that resulted from rising floodwaters. It was damage that resulted from a window blowing out or siding blowing off, or most commonly, your roof has problems. You'll get shingles that get lost, and then the water comes in from the top
right.
and goes down. So wind and hail is probably consistently one of the more expensive flood policies. Again, I mean, on my personal house, and I'm nowhere near the water, my wind and hail insurance is about $1,300 a year. So, but you got to consider if a tree gets blown over and it falls into your structure, that's a wind claim. So, for example, my oceanfront that I've got for sale now, we had a flood claim and they had a wind claim. They had a flood claim because some of the sand and the dirt and some of the things on the ground level were affected by some of the wave action and the water that came up during the storm. But they lost siding, a window blew out, and they lost a bunch of shingles off of the original roof that they had. So the wind and hail claim was considerably higher in the payout than the flood damage or the flood claim was. Wind and hail insurance is pretty much going to be required for any mortgage that you get on any property anywhere near the coast.
How expensive is it?
Couple thousand dollars. I mean, I haven't seen a wind and hail policy under $100,000 on a single-family home in a really long time.
You're talking about $100,000.
If you get into a condo or a townhome or something that's smaller, that may need less insurance anyway just by nature, you might get into under $1,000. But, yeah. You know, they can be expensive. My oceanfront property, the wind and hail policy is $2,200 a year.
So you're talking $100,000 is coverage, not cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just want to clarify that. I want to move into one more direction here. This is sort of like a due diligence checklist in a way. And let me just rattle off some of these things, and then you can respond if you want. Anytime you're looking at waterfront properties, it takes extra due diligence. You know, we talk about due diligence as one of the most important things that we do as realtors in guiding our buyers and sellers in terms of getting all the information that's pertinent to the property. But in your area, you're going to have some environmental operating permits. You're going to have potential of wetlands. You're going to have some shoreline or watersheds. You may have some flood zones. You may have property that has some endangered species. You may even have seismic safety zones. I don't know if you have that there, but you do find that, especially on the West Coast. Water rights, oil, gas, mineral, and timber rights. These are some of the things that needs to be on your checklist, right? You want to talk about any of those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And especially if you're dealing with waterfront properties, to check with the appropriate governmental agency to tell you what those setbacks are to determine if you have conforming or non-conforming properties.
Now, you know, I'm on the Commercial Forms Committee, and a number of years ago I recognized that only a few states had a due diligence checklist for land. We have it for residential. And I brought that to our committee. It's called Land Information Worksheet. And when you sell a home, it's required whether you're selling yourself or going through a professional real estate organization that you provide a copy of your checklist. On a home, we observed that there were like 28 issues and observations. And when we got down, we actually identified 93 with the five states that I pulled in for examples and some that I had, Cindy Chandler and a few others. And we ended up with 73 issues and observations in doing a land transaction. And now that we've gone through some of the things we're talking about, we've got another committee meeting next Tuesday. And I think I'm going to bring up a couple more things we want to add to that due diligence checklist. But this is real important. I mean, all this stuff has to be disclosed by law and legally when transferring property, whether you're selling it yourself, whether you're auctioning it, or whether you're using a licensed real estate agent or realtor to do so. Is there anything else that we haven't covered here that would might qualify as a due diligence item?
Necessarily. I think that one of the other things to consider, especially in beach properties, is due to storms and washover and natural disaster situations, you may find an old septic tank that washed back on your property from another one. Even though this home may be connected to sewer and always has been, you know, I've seen it where they'll be out doing some landscaping in the yard, and then lo and behold, they find some leach field lines in a septic system, but it was never permitted for that lot. So you got to remember, the earth and the things move, especially when you're in areas that are prone to flooding or prone to wave action.
That's crazy.
It's not crazy. You sure you want to go to the beach
that
and sell real
so
estate?
That is so funny.
Why is it funny?
So you might just find a septic tank.
Yeah,
or a bathtub. You may just find a bathtub.
Like endangered species and endangered wildlife, you know, a woodpecker can impede development. In the coastal areas, you know, we're one of the only homes to the Venus flytrap in the entire world. If you run into Venus flytraps on your property, you're probably going to have some type of an environmental regulation that's going to protect those that may limit what you want to do on that property.
Oh, I can see Teresa now next time she goes to the beach. She's going to be out looking for Venus flytraps.
I didn't even know they grew down there.
Venus flytraps and pitcher plants are the two big ones.
These are all part of the 168 varietals that are found in wetlands, right?
Yes.
Thank you, Mark Seelinger, for identifying all those for me. He's quite a guy.
So how long is your typical due diligence period there? It's like here, as we usually do, 30 days and 45 day to close.
A good, if we're talking about a land transaction, a good realtor who's going to list it is going to do all of the research and all of the data to know exactly what they're selling to be able to market it properly for the end buyer. If you have someone who wants to rush and just get a sign up and put it in the MLS and say you got a new listing, then I'm going to have a longer due diligence period on a property like that. But when I list properties, I do all the research. There are no questions for a buyer. I have the answer to any question you could just about ask on zoning, setbacks, building envelope, anything that could be pertinent. And if you set yourself up for success as a realtor on the front end, you can negotiate a shorter due diligence on the back end, because what else do they need to find out? So I've seen everything from 5 days due diligence. We want to verify the information you've provided us, Ms. Asbury, all the way to 6 to 9 months. Right now I'm working on a large land tract that's on the water that the gentleman wants to make a residential subdivision. And we actually make the due diligence triggered by a action, not a date. So, for example, we are going to run our due diligence 30 days after receipt of a new wetlands delineation to be provided by the buyer at the buyer's expense. Now, that may take 6 or 8 months for them to get, just depending on how busy everyone is. But if we get it in 4 months, then that's great. So, you know, in some of those transactions, you'll set up your due diligence triggered by something that happens rather than a hard date. Does that make sense?
Yes. It's very different from what I'm used to. And they don't teach you any of this stuff in real estate school.
Oh, really? How about land?
Not a whole lot. Well, this is land.
I know.
It's
That's
just
why
beach
we have
land.
This show.
This is good information.
And the other angle, too, is if you're just talking about like a residential building lot or something, you can, again, trigger that due diligence to be 14 days after receipt of a septic permit by the county.
So if you're a real estate agent working in the mountains and you have a friend who wants to buy a house at the beach,
you send them to Christina.
Get a referral.
I was going to say, I pay really good referrals, really good referrals.
Hey, yeah, with about 5 or 6 minutes left, what else do we need to cover about these issues? Because I want to move you and let you talk about what's going on with land real estate currently now. Is there anything else we need to talk about?
The last thing really to talk about is highest and best use.
Okay, please.
Not everything is meant to be houses. Not all land is meant to be a housing development. Sometimes there are just tracts of land that people will think are unusable, which isn't the case. Kind of like those oceanfront lots that the houses get messed up on and they can't meet the setback requirements. There is a buyer for every piece of land. And especially down here near the coast, we're seeing more and more solar and more, you know, people are talking about wind farms and things like that. Depending on the seller's financial goals, maybe conservation easements or putting the land into a mitigation bank would bring it a higher sales price. You know, most developers around here don't want to pay but between $1,500 to $2,500 per acre for wetlands. In that situation, depending on how much wetlands are going for in the mitigation bank at that point in time or what the supply of mitigatable properties there are, it may make more sense for the property owner to retain those wetlands and put it into a mitigation bank to get more money in the long term. You got to think outside the box. There's a buyer for every parcel. The other thing to keep in mind is affordable housing options are always going to be limited in coastal communities because higher land prices just won't support a lower priced product. There are always going to be zoning restrictions that will control density near those AECs or areas of environmental concern that can limit a developer on the usable land that they have. Always talk to local planning and zoning offices to find creative ways to be able to offer affordable workforce housing options. I think that your planners, your local floodplain administrator, your zoning officer, all those people are useful relationships to build as a land practitioner near the coast.
Relationships are key in any business, and, you know, I teach that in my land classes, you know, all the different people that you work with and why, and you better be able to call them at home at night. I mean, that's when you have the relationship, right? But
yeah, that's why we have such a good network of people, and you always have to know people who are smarter than you about other things.
That's why we have you on our show today. So, what's going on with land? I got about a minute down there. Prices going up, prices going down. About half a minute.
Prices are going up, but that's due to a limited supply of housing. Again, the military base really is one of the main driving factors for our housing needs, and the entire Special Operations Force of the Marine Corps is relocating to my area.
All right.
So we've got about 900 Special Ops guys we've got to find houses for, and the developers are trying to stay ahead of them.
Yeah, that sounds great. So how do people get in touch with us? Let's let you do your commercial.
And I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. You know, you can find me at ChristinaAsbury.com. That's my website. My email, again, super easy. ChristinaSellsRealEstate@gmail.com. You can always call, text me at 910-262-3948. Or just Google me. I'm pretty easy to find, and most everybody around here knows of me or where I may be. But it's probably on the road or in the woods.
That's the way I like to do business.
And, you know, we're seeing all kinds of other little things pop up. Interestingly enough, I listed my first vineyard this past week, little 9.5 acre Scuppernong vineyard. You don't see those pop up in this area very often. Horse farms are getting a lot of traffic on horse properties. Sold a horse farm recently. I've got another one coming up, so. There's a little bit of everything. Because I'm a mile from the beach don't mean I'm just playing with the sand.
There you go. Christina, you've been a great guest today. Thank you for joining us. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics that you would like to suggest, we would appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public and, most importantly, for real estate agents who do not have a source for land education. All of our shows after their broadcast this morning will be downloaded on the master website, www.letstalkland.net, and Podbeam and Spotify. My email is lou@mylandpro.com. My cell number is 336-669-1405. Teresa?
And I'm Teresa Martin, and my email is I don't know what it is. Teresa, T-E-R-E-S-A, teresa.mylandpro@gmail.com.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Nobody can ever spell my name. That's the problem.
Rodney, yes. Your turn.
All right. They can go to our website, Lou. Go to 1090 WKTE and click on our website there. And also, they can download the Simple Radio app and listen to us anywhere in the world.
How about the universe?
The universe also.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, we get out there, don't we?
We do.
And we're beach music and oldies, and we only play happy music.
Happy, happy music.
Only happy music. Yeah. And we've gotten several awards. Let's talk about
this. Yeah, nominated 5 years in a row as being the top radio station for beach and oldies in the Triad and the East Coast here.
And you got a nice award not too long ago.
Yes, last year I got the Reader's Choice Award for the Announcer of the Year for 2019.
Wonder why.
I have no clue, but I think that you're in the running with me now.
Oh, you think?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Shadow, we'll have to have talk about this. Hey, thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Blue.